Now I'll start with the why do I want to serve? And I would like to serve because our current representation is relatively weak and ineffective for Southeast Alaska for the things that we need. People, especially as I've gone around the district and talked with people, I've really heard that people want someone who has been there and done that, has some life experience, job experience, business experience that they can relate to, who has some understanding of what they're going through. As well as my life experience, I will have a seat in the majority. And as politics go, it does make a big difference when we have a legislator in the majority who can chair committees and be on more committees and have greater influence over the things. My qualifications include my experience with Representative Peggy Wilson. She, of course, was House Whip, Chair of Transportation, Vice Chair of Resources. So I watched someone who was really in the know there in the legislature. Ran the Chamber of Commerce and also Sitka Works, my years at Sitka Works. I created an organization here in town after our mill shut down that would help people start and grow their small businesses, as well as training for new jobs, because economic development is really what I'm about. Thank you.
Jonathan?
Yeah, my name is Jonathan Christ Tompkins, and I'm up for re-election to serve two more years as your legislator and the representative for all the communities in this district. And I'm excited to continue serving because I think we face some historic problems in Alaska, and I want to help solve them. And I think we need people who want to be a part of that solution. I'm not really a party or partisan person. I'm more like trying to solve problems for what they are, because at the end of the day, that's what really matters for people and for the future of the state. And I believe in bringing a collaborative and public service-oriented attitude towards government and to the legislature in particular. I bring effective and high-energy representation to this district. I'm excited to keep doing that. I was born here, I was raised here, I care about this place. I know this district like the back of my hand at this point. I mean, you could drop me in any community, and I think I know probably half the houses on any given street. And I think from that, you get a really ground-level sense of what issues, of course big, but also the issues small that people face that are specific to communities, specific to neighborhoods even, certainly specific to industries. And I think that kind of 80-hour a week representation really helps when we have a district as big and vast as ours is and a lot of issues that face us. So I want to keep bringing that public service approach to the legislature, and I want to solve these problems, namely our budget, and get it balanced. And I'm excited to have the opportunity to do that for two more years.
Okay, we're going to start with you on the next one, Jonathan. Kind of leads right into that. What are your top three legislative priorities?
Thanks, Steve. The three priorities I would prioritize as important this coming session are balancing the budget, oil and gas tax credit reform, and economic diversification and value-added industry. And for the first, balancing the budget, I mean this state, I think everything else is going to become moot if we don't have a future in which we don't hit $0 in our savings account and have the engine start sputtering for the economy of the state and the functionality of the state. I mean, it's that will be a day of reckoning for kicking the can too long, and I don't have interest in kicking the can, and I'd like to see that solved and the budget balanced and a fiscal plan affected. Oil and gas tax credit reform is related to that. Especially with the Armstrong Oil and Gas and Kaylis fines, and 88 Energy is talking about some shale prospects in the North Slope. There's a lot of potential revenue down the road when the infrastructure is put in, and the upside of that is potentially lost, and right now we're also expending so much money annually that it's difficult to balance the budget, and I'd like to see further action and reform on that issue. And finally, economic diversification and development within this region, getting more dollars, more economic benefit for existing industries, including fishing, strikes me as incredibly important, bringing a new generation of fishermen into this region, trying to increase resident ownership of permits in this region, so less people coming up from Washington and Oregon and more people coming up through our schools and getting into the fleets, Troll, Gillnet, Seine, whatever it might be. But really every sector of the economy, whether it's timber and wood and value added in that sector or tourism, all the legs on our economic table, strengthening them, diversifying them. Those would be my three priorities.
Thank you, Jonathan. And Sheila, your top three legislative priorities.
Okay. Clearly, it would be hard not to have the priority of balancing the budget. That's something that everybody knows we have to do. My job, especially being in the majority, would be having a strong effect on making sure that District 35 is fairly treated in that budget and how it affects all the industries, fishing, timber, tourism, healthcare. Transportation, as I go about the district, people bring up the ferries. We have to deal with keeping our ferry system sustainable, viable, and fully funded. We have to look at roads too. And so the road from Cape to Petersburg, if people want that, any other roads that seem viable to help us get around and to help our economy be strong and grow. And then economic development is a strong priority of mine. We have to increase the revenue that we get from a strong economy. We have to be developing more of our resources. Ultimately, someone has to be producing something and selling something and creating jobs and paying taxes for an economy to be strong. We can't just tax each other to death. So those three. Budget, transportation, especially ferries, and economic development.
Okay, thank you. Next question is relative to the state budget, and we're going to start with you this time, Sheila. What are your ideas for increasing revenue and or decreasing expenses in order to balance the state's budget?
Again, I'm going to reiterate encouraging and supporting economic growth. We can't just take in each other's laundry and hope to get ahead. We have to be developing our resources in this state. We've been dependent on the tax revenue for a long time because those oil companies have been producing and selling oil for us. We used to be 90% dependent on oil. Now it's down to 75%. We have to have other economies growing to help support this state. Taxes will be discussed. I'm not going to be the one that will bring those up. The governor will bring them up. We'll discuss them and evaluate which ones make sense. As far as decreasing expenditures, when we get to the legislature, the departments will bring forth their recommendations, and in the finance subcommittees, we'll evaluate those recommendations and see where the cuts can be made. Last year, the House majority did support the governor's sustainable budget plan. The minority voted against that plan repeatedly, causing a stalemate until millions more from the Constitutional Budget Reserve were leveraged back into the budget. Ultimately, the governor vetoed much of the additional money and felt forced to veto part of our PFD. So I will work with the majority to try to get those costs down. Progress was also made this year in reducing the largest cost drivers of the operating budget in Medicaid, criminal justice, and the unfunded liabilities to our state retirement system by close to $1 million. I'll work with the majority to keep whittling away at the costs. The old tax credits bill too, HB 247, also cut a huge amount out of what we'll be giving out in credits in the future to the oil companies, and more cuts will be made in the upcoming sessions. The oil companies were extremely unhappy with this bill. My opponent voted no on this. I will work to see that more further cuts are done to oil taxes in the future, but progress has been made. We can only do what we can do at the time.
Thank you. And Jonathan, same question. What are your ideas for increasing revenue and or decreasing expenses in order to balance the state's budget?
Sure, sure, thank you. I mean, a couple of clarifications first. I mean, in terms of the majority-minority dichotomy, I reject the assumption that Sheila would necessarily be in the majority next year, and me, the converse. Right now, the math in the legislature is effectively a 20-20 split in the House of Representatives. This race, among others, potentially determining that balance of power. And we have basically a choice of a rail belt Republican-led majority that has historically and will continue to cut the budget and attempt to balance the budget on the backs of coastal Alaska, or a potentially more diverse and coastal Alaska-led majority organization that would be bipartisan in nature and characteristic of the bipartisan working group that we had for 6 years from 06 to 2012. So I reject that assumption, and I think at this point in time, there's as much chance or greater likelihood I will be in the majority and Sheila would not. So that's the first clarification I'd like to make. The second clarification is I think the characterization of what happened with the budget this last year is inaccurate. The sustainable budget plan introduced by the governor was held up by legislators of both parties, and that part is accurate, but not by the minority or any organization as a whole. I think what Sheila is referring to are negotiations with the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which were protracted and took a long time, and there were a lot of reasons that that happened, but it was ultimately settled and that budget was passed. Similarly, with Sheila's reference to the oil and gas tax credit bill, I also feel that's misleading and inaccurate. There were several iterations of that bill. I was on the Rules Committee that considered one of the later iterations of that bill. And that bill was rejected at one point because it was too favorable to oil and gas companies, and the certain credits that were being cut were favorable to the big three, the legacy producers, BP, Exxon, and Conoco, and disfavorable to the sort of scrap and independents that are trying to break into the North Slope. So there were many, many, many votes. Some people voted yes, and then they voted no because there are different iterations of that bill, but the characterization previously offered, I disagree with. To succinctly answer the question, I support further reductions in the budget, which is something that distinguishes me from some members of my party, and I've supported the operating budget that has cut the budget. And for revenues, I broadly support the governor's plan.
We'll let you keep going here a little bit as we discuss capital projects. And Jonathan, you're up first for this. As you know, many jobs are created in Sitka from capital projects being funded by the state. How will you be able to help ensure Sitka gets its fair share of the funding?
Capital projects, unfortunately, don't really exist these days. The capital budget that the legislature passed last year was effectively all federal pass-through funds. Because we're running a circa $3.3 billion budget deficit, and there's not really funding for capital projects these days, and it's been that way now for two fiscal years. Likely will continue to be that way for several more fiscal years. I think probably the only likelihood of capital projects is through a possible bond package that might come through the legislature in future years. I mean, I think there is a lot of focus on the operating budget and geographic equitability associated with the operating budget, which I referenced previously. And there's certain programs and services that are very important to our part of state, ADF&G, the ferry system, public radio being a few, and there's some that are more important to other parts of the state, especially the rail belt. And I think it's very important for equitability to be achieved when we're writing the budget. I've used my position and role in the Constitutional Budget Reserve negotiations these last 2 years, even though the budget as a whole was coming down, to make sure that those reductions were equitable and not disproportionate in our region. And some examples of that are a $250,000 in public radio funding in FY16 that was secured, $4 million in ferry system funding that was secured this most recent budget cycle in FY17. And to me, that's ensuring equitability in the budget and balance, even while honoring the obligation that we need to cut costs across the board. And that is still happening, and I should add, needs to happen and continue to happen. Budget cuts will continue to happen. It's going to be painful for all of us, but it's fiscally and mathematically necessary, and I think that's an important reality for all of us to confront. So, the question is on capital budgets. I mean, capital projects. I think on the budget as a whole, we have to think about it holistically. But certainly, when the day comes that we do have a capital budget again, and I hope we do, and we need that for the construction industry and to make sure that basic infrastructure is being built, I think it's important to use the political leverage you have. And I've done that the last 2 years and seek to continue to do that.
Thank you. And Sheila, As you know, many jobs are created in Sitka from capital projects being funded by the state. How will you be able to ensure Sitka gets its fair share of the funding?
So yes, only at this time, only recurring capital projects have been funded. There won't be new ones. So it's going to be important to keep an eye on those projects and make sure that the work gets done and make sure that that money doesn't find itself going somewhere else. That if those monies have been appropriated for projects to our district, that indeed that work happens and that money gets spent and those jobs do get created. The only source of revenue we're going to see really for capital projects is the passenger fee head tax, which has to be dispersed and spent on the communities fairly. So we can see the result of the capital fee head tax with our Centennial Building, with the Seawalk, incredibly nice things that have been done in our community that help to make our community look good to visitors and bring more tourism into our community. So we want to make sure that any monies that continue to come into that that tax get spent wisely in our communities.
Great. Switch topics a little bit to energy now. Sheila, you're first on this one. As you know, low energy costs help to bring in new business. How will you be able to help keep energy rates reasonable for consumers in Sitka and the rest of our district?
It's a touchy question in Sitka right now, but encouraging hydro projects around the district and other sustainable energy projects that can happen around the district is something that I would work on. The other part of energy costs is that you have to have people and businesses using that energy that's being generated in order to spread out the costs. So for instance, Viking Lumber on Prince of Wales Island uses 60% of the energy down there. So if it were gone, the energy costs spread all out over the remaining people and businesses, their costs would go way up. So again, back to more economic development. You have to have things going on in your community so that you can spread out those energy costs and they're not just divided up over the few remaining people. Thanks.
Thank you. And Jonathan, for you about energy. As you know, low energy costs help to bring in new business. How would you be able to help keep energy rates reasonable for consumers in Sitka along with the rest of our district?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, sort of, I think, two ways to slice that question, because in Sitka we have a different sort of energy reality as other parts of the district, but in Sitka it's a huge issue, obviously. It's, I think, hugely adverse to the economic future of the community to have ratcheting energy rates. It's the circulatory system of the economy, if you will, having affordable and abundant energy, and you see that replicated in jurisdictions across the country and the world, and certainly within Alaska. We're relatively limited having the state in this deficit scenario as it is, and no capital budget. I mean, to me, a key priority is prioritizing whatever funds we might have, and be that a bond bill in a couple of years, or whatever other funding might become available, and directing it towards core infrastructure, and particularly energy infrastructure. And I think those decisions made in the past have been intelligent and long-sighted and will pay dividends for years and years to come, and want to make sure that that prioritization continues in the future. On sort of a related note, there was a sort of redo of the power cost equalization formula in the legislature this year, and that's Sitka is not a power cost equalization eligible community, but other communities in our district are. And that was a rewrite that was ultimately, I thought, progressive and equitable towards communities that are facing very high energy costs. And that's through and through now. That was, I think, a good statutory touch-up. But that's a sort of another element of the energy equation that I think is important. I just had one other thought. As far as businesses in the community, and this is a piece of legislation that was active last year, and I think will likely become law in the next 2 years, is opening up the energy efficiency revolving loan fund to nonprofits and other entities in communities. And this is a revolving loan fund the state has allowed bonding authority for, that allow nonprofits that are cash poor but in very energy inefficient structures to access low interest financing that is paid back in a very sort of intelligent manner that allows your reduced rates to actually be your interest payments. And right now it's has rather strict and conservative eligibility criteria, and this is something that I think actually could have a very real world impact on nonprofits in particular in this community, churches, soup kitchens, you name it. And so that's maybe another point.
Okay. Continuing on with the Alaska Marine Highway, and this starts with you, Jonathan. Lay out your thoughts on the future of the Alaska Marine Highway system and how you can educate our legislatures on the importance of Southeast Alaska's highways.
Yeah, I think we're on the brink of systemic change, and it's necessary. I mean, one, we can't starve the system. You can't slash tens of millions out of the budget and expect it to even marginally function, and that gets considered and tossed around in the legislature. It hasn't come to be. Some of the more draconian cuts have been backfilled. As I mentioned, this most recent year, $4 million in the Constitutional Budget Reserve compromise that was ultimately passed by the legislature. But you know, that's sort of the year-to-year thing, and I'm much more interested, equally interested in the long-term future of the system and ensuring that it's sustainable and functional. I think some of the conversations led by Southeast Conference and other entities are healthy in thinking about an independent governance structure, similar to the University of Alaska, which is has a governance external to the legislature, in which you have regents appointed by the governor who govern that system and provide year-to-year, month-to-month management. I think potentially a similar system in the ferry with the Alaska Marine Highway could work and would be a good idea. The devil always in the details, of course. But with the ferry system, I think it's been difficult for that system to create an effective strategic plan that has coherence on a multi-decade time horizon, because you have different administrations coming in every 4 years, sometimes every 8 years, or when Governor Palin resigned, every 6 years, and you have a completely new strategic direction the system goes in, and it's very difficult for a system to succeed when you have cleaning house, new leadership installed, and they go, you know, 180 degrees from where they might have been going previously. So that's a thought there, but there has to be systemic reform. We have an aging fleet. We're on the brink of having to reconsider how business as usual with the ferry system is done, because things are going to be changing.
Just a reminder, we're almost done with our prepared questions, so if anybody has additional questions, this would be a good time to Mandy. Okay, Sheila, with you, Alaska Marine Highway. Lay out your thoughts on the future of the Alaska Marine Highway system and how you can educate other legislators on the importance of Southeast Alaska's highway.
I had coffee the other morning in Petersburg with a man from DOT who reminded me that the Alaska Marine Highway is just a highway. If we're trying to argue for keeping it funded with people from the rail belt, cost millions of dollars just to keep snow cleared off the highway from Fairbanks to Anchorage. It costs millions of dollars to operate our marine highway system also. And we need to keep reminding those legislators, who, by the way, ride the ferry a lot, that it's just the highway and it needs to be funded. That being said, I was very glad to know that this year's Southeast Conference got a contract with the government to do some studying into a new governance system for the Alaska Marine Highway, because truly we do need to make sure that it is sustainable over the long term. We can't just keep pouring money into it. So I'm very, very hopeful that they will come up with a report that does have a design for a system that will be sustainable And if they do, we will take it to the legislature, and I will work with Senator Stedman in the Senate to make sure that we get that legislation through, and we do get a ferry system that has a new governance system and is sustainable over the long term.
Thank you. Okay, we've got a have a couple questions here from the group. Some of them are specific towards one or the other of you. A couple of them are general. First one is Peggy Wilson prime sponsored 6 to 7 bills her first 4 years. How does this compare to what Jonathan or what Sheila would expect to do? Jonathan, you want to go first on that?
Sure. I think I know the intent of that question, but the question is, it literally reads, different legislators have sort of different ambitions in the number of bills that they sponsor, write, and introduce. I'm especially sort of policy interested and ambitious, and am active in a lot of legislation. Some of those pieces of legislation turn into amendments and riders and get attached to another bill, hopefully in a friendly way, not in a parasitic way. But yeah, I'm a sort of a high legislative energy output kind of person, and I guess is it six to eight is I think it's on the higher end of things in terms of prime sponsorship in the House, and I think it's been similar for me.
Sheila? Want me to read it again?
No, I think I understand.
Okay.
Representative Wilson did introduce 15 bills of her own in her first 4 years. I know that she had a strong focus on education, making sure that education funding was fair for the district. So that was something that she was pushing at the time. She did get 5 of her bills passed during her first 4 years. I think that's not untypical. I can't say that I have a particularly have any one agenda that I hope to push when I'm in the legislature, but I would hope that the bills that I manage to get through are equal to those of the best legislators that are doing the work for their constituents.
Thank you. This one is to Jonathan. It says, you withheld your vote to pass a budget and forced adding money into the budget from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. How did that meet the governor's expectation of the legislature?
Yeah, let's unpack this question a little bit. So in the legislative process, the Alaska Constitution provides that to take money out of savings, there has to be negotiation and a compromise between both caucuses within the legislature. And so usually that's a sort of moderating of two positions and budgeting perspectives. And that's what's occurred in the last 2 years in the legislature. I think it's an important process that ultimately creates a more moderate and compromise-oriented budget. In the last 2 years, it's also produced a budget that's more equitable to rural and coastal Alaska, importantly so. The process, the outcome ultimately has been good. The process has been ugly and dysfunctional, and there's a lot of fault for that. Partly because the conversations have been initiated so terribly late in the process. And, you know, it's maybe not worth interrogating, you know, who exactly was involved in that, but I think everyone can agree the process could have been much better, but the outcome was important and decent, and it makes for a more moderate and equitable budget, and it's been to the benefit of this district.
Thank you. This was one directed to you, Sheila.
Mm-hmm.
Says, I am unsatisfied with the Republicans not working with Governor Walker. You say you will have a seat at the table. I want to see you work with Walker. Please address this issue.
Being responsible for what happened in the past is not something I'm going to accept responsibility for. We all go up there to work together with each other. I know that the Republican-led majority did include 4 people that were in the minority, and they did work together with each other to pass a sustainable budget. I think that I'm seen as a pretty moderate person that works with people across the board and listens to people, so I don't know why I won't go there and work as cooperatively as I possibly can with all parties, including the governor, to get the work done.
This is for both of you. The governor just announced that he was not moving forward with his plan to sell pension obligation bonds. Do you support this as a solution to our public pension obligations? And if not, what do you support as an alternative? Let's start with you, Sheila.
Is the question whether I supported the governor selling bonds or otherwise?
It sounds like, I can be corrected from the audience here, but it sounds like it's asking if you support the decision not to sell the bonds as a leading towards this group.
I do.
Okay. So to clarify that,
I support
you
the governor
not
selling
bonds
to support
the
getting it correct. Yes.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I have a similarly cautious perspective as Sheila on this question. I think my foremost, I understand the sort of logic and the financial value proposition that the pension obligation bonds theoretically at least offer, as well as the risk that comes with it. My gut is pretty cautious, especially given the exposure we have financially to the state, and if that were to go south, that would be like a, I don't know, 100-pound brick breaking the camel's back. But I think process-wise is where my greatest concern comes, in that these pension obligation bonds were going to be sold in the interim between legislative sessions with not necessarily a high level of vetting, particularly by the legislative committees of jurisdiction that would be able to crunch the numbers and take testimony and assess the risks and the benefits and weigh them against each other. So if only on a process level, I think this is the wise path forward, and I'm glad the governor recalibrated his path.
And we have a final question from the group. I'll rephrase this a little bit and make it available for both of you, and basically say, are either one of you inclined to share who you're voting for president?
Why? We all have an incredibly difficult choice when it comes to voting for president this year, and a big part of why I decided to run for this office is that I feel the frustration at the national level, but I feel that I can have some impact at this level, and that's why I'm running here. And good luck with your vote on the presidential level.
I echo Sheila's sentiments. I feel like this is almost an election. It's not who you're voting for, it's who you're not voting for. I won't be voting for Donald Trump, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, we have a last question that snuck in here. ANB, and this is for both of you. ANB, ANS, Grand Camp passed a resolution to have the new board of the AMHS elected from the communities served and actual regular users of the ferry system. The Division of Elections could hold these elections as they do local
option
elections with tiered seats?
Yes.
Would you support such an idea? Maybe start with you, Sheila.
On the face of it, it sounds like a good idea. Since we are hopeful to have a whole new governance system over the Alaska Marine Highway, it might be moot in the future, but it sounds good now. Our Marine Transportation Advisory Board hasn't had as much power as they hoped to have when it was created. So things get left in the hands of DOT personnel too much. So I'd be all for strengthening local input into how the Marine Highway system operates.
You want me to reread that, or are you okay?
I think I got it, but it can be corrected if I'm going in the wrong direction. On its face, it sounds like a reasonable proposal, and I suspect one that Southeast Conference will take into consideration, and not unprecedented relative to regional education attendance areas, REAAs is the policy jargon, that actually exists within our district right now, Southeast Island School District in Chatham, where you have multiple communities coming together to create a governance structure that is semi-regional in nature. So I could see using that template to inform how such a proposal could be realized or potentially hybridized with a more traditional appointed by the governor, creating a long-term governing board kind of governance structure for the ferry system. So strikes me as an original idea and one worth consideration, and I'm sure it will be by the good folks that are doing that work going forward.
Okay, thank you. And that concludes the questions from the public, so we'll go to the closing statements. And Sheila will begin with you, a minute for why vote for you.
Okay. Legislators have two jobs, one to approve the budget and two to make laws. With a seat on the majority and a chair of at least one committee, I'll be in a stronger position to negotiate a sustainable budget that also takes care of our Southeast Alaska needs. I'll vote to accept the budget as it comes out. There has been a Republican-led majority for quite some time. It may possibly be a bipartisan majority. I can always choose to be in either majority. Either way, the vote goes this time around. When it comes to creating new laws, I have the wisdom gained from many years of being in the workforce, running businesses, raising a family, owning homes and paying the bills. I have a network of contacts all over the state who I worked with in those jobs and businesses, who are there to help provide information and insight to me. I am a strong, resilient, and creative leader, and I will bring stronger representation and greater influence for Southeast Alaska to the legislature, and I'm asking for your vote.
Thank you, Sheila. And also, Jonathan, why vote for you?
Yeah, I'd like to continue bringing a higher energy and collaborative approach to the legislature, and I think that brings a couple of specific positive benefits to this district. I'm in active conversations with colleagues around Alaska about what a coalition would look like in the House, and I'm actively pushing that forward. I think that's important for the future of Alaska. It was good the last time it existed, and we desperately need it again because the last 4 years in the House have not been good for this state. Similarly, I value relationships and having intelligent, thoughtful, mutually respectful relationships, including with those in the governor's office, which also brings dividends to this district. And so that's something I put an emphasis on and also comes to fruition in various forms to the district. Namely, there's $1.12 million that's gonna come to rebuild the HPR Peterson intersection, which will be announced in the coming week. And that's federal pass-through funding, but it came through a long and at times painful protracted conversation with the Department of Transportation to prioritize those funds here as opposed to other parts of the state. So that also produces results for the district, and I'd like to keep doing that. But in general, we've got a big problem to solve. I'm really committing to solving it. I don't care if it's with Republicans or Democrats or rail belt folks or coastal folks or rural folks or anyone. I care about solving problems. We need to solve problems, and we've got some heck of a big problem to solve, and I'm eager to give it my best shot these next 2 years and do my honest best.
Jonathan Christ Tompkins, Sheila Finkenbinder, thank you for your time here today with the forum. Thank you all. Obviously, we all have a lot to think about, and most important, a vote to make.